Hello, Broad Appeal listeners. This is part two of our Oscar conversation. If you haven't listened to the first episode, maybe you should. And here's the rest of the conversation. Okay, and we're back. Sean, how did that face mask do?
It was amazing, Brian. I feel 10 years younger, and weirdly, my teeth are also cleaner, too.
Believe it or not, we have covered more than half of the nominees. We spoke about the six who appear in the same film.
Yeah, and the second half is always supposed to be shorter than the first half. We're doing it right.
Good to know. That leaves four nominees, so let's dig into them.
Eres el único director español que conoce mi familia.
Tu nueva familia.
You're being so much like your father.
Do not compare me to my father.
I didn't compare you to him. I said you were acting like him.
You're exactly like your mother. Everything you're complaining about her, you're doing.
Don't you approve? One who keeps tearing around. Where are the clouds? There ought to be clouds.
Every day I wake up and I hope you're dead. Dead like it. If I could guarantee Henry would be okay, I'd hope he'd get an illness and then get hit by a car and die.
Somebody we are trying to give children somebody positive ways to deal
somebody
with their
sit in my chair and ruin my seat.
Have you seen what it's like out there, Murray? Of being everybody just yells and screams at each other. Nobody's civil anymore. Nobody thinks what it's like
somebody
to be the other guy.
Too much.
They think that we'll just
somebody
sit there and take it like well. Good little boys. That
somebody
we won't werewolf and go wild.
You finished? And put me through not everybody, and I'll and tell you this, not everybody is awful.
For being alive. Make
I hope you know
alive.
That you made today a very special
make
day
alive.
By just your being you.
Make me
there's no one in the whole world like you and I like you just the way you are.
¿Tienes pareja ahora?
Sí. ¿Y tú?
No.
But alone is alone, not alone.
One of them is a previous Oscar winner, two-time Oscar winner. A multiple-time nominee who has not been at the Oscars for many, many years, and it's not been for lack of good quality performances. I'm talking about someone that I think has become more beloved with every passing day, and that's Tom Hanks.
Yeah, America's dad.
He is America's dad. He's America's something. He's America's soul. And I have to say, like, there was a period of time, I don't know, around the Tom Hanks years of, like, Saving Private Ryan, like, Apollo 13, he was leaning into maybe center-right territory. Like, I'm not even talking about whatever his personal politics are, just the kind of, like, roles he was taking were too American nostalgia for me. But, like, there's been something recently, I think it's probably about the fact that Tom Hanks has been overlooked by the Academy for a number of performances people loved. You know, Captain Phillips, I thought he was great in Bridge of Spies.
Bridge of Spies
to me was, like, modern day Jimmy Stewart. I thought it was excellent.
Yeah.
And then, you know, things like David S. Pumpkins and the Trump voter on Black Jeopardy.
Yeah, that was so
those
good.
SNL skits. Like,
yeah.
I think Tom Hanks is just, you know, it's kind of like Brad Pitt. He's just mellowed into the most perfect version of himself. So here he is back at the Oscars for a performance in a little film called A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, in which he plays none other than Mr. Fred Rogers.
Yeah, now this was a bit of a different viewing experience for me because, I mean, I have pieced together who Mr. Rogers is. I have never seen an episode of his program. And, you know, we actually saw this film only last night. It was surprisingly full, the cinema, but it was also the smallest one and there was no later screening after the one we saw.
There was just one screening in Clapham,
yeah.
Which if you know London, you know what that means, mm-hmm. In Clapham. And it was at 6:40 p.m.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was mostly filled with senior citizens. Well, there were a few gay boys. They had distinctly American accents, though. I'm not just talking about me. There were a few others, a smattering.
Yeah, and, like, it might be one of those things where it has to open because it's BAFTA-nominated, and then, like, within a week it'll close. Or it's one of those things where, you know, a little bit of word of mouth will keep it alive a bit further. But I don't know.
Well, okay, here's the thing. Let me jump in there. I don't think we're saying it'll close because it's necessarily a bad movie. It's a good movie.
It's Mariel Heller.
It's Mariel Heller, who we love. We can get into that. But I think what I'm saying is it's so American. It's kind of like last year when Vice came out, because obviously Vice was a big Oscar player. And it's like, who in Britain really wants to see a long thing about Dick Cheney? Who even remembers Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld? Well, it's even more so when it's a beloved children's television host that literally no one's heard of. And I have to say, it was a weird experience for me as an American viewer sitting there in Clapham watching this, because, like, there were moments that I was chuckling about, or, like, mouthing along the lyrics, or, like, snapping along with Mr. Rogers at different points, that I'm sure everyone else in the theater was like, who is this?
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah, who is this asshole fag?
But actually, no, you were very, I have to say, you were very discreet, because I know you could have, in different circumstances, been whooping and hollering and slapping your knee.
Oh, dear, I keep it discreet.
Yeah.
Especially in Clapham. So anyway,
it would be called Dead in Clapham.
Here's the thing. I think it would be such a different experience to watch Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood in any American context, because there's a scene in the film where Tom Hanks, as Mr. Rogers, rides the subway in New York City with the journalist played by Matthew Rhys. And when the people notice who he is, there's just this sudden change in all the passengers in the subway, and they start singing the theme song to Mr. Rogers. And there is, like, this experience that you have watching the movie, and it's because Mariel Heller has decided to almost frame the entire movie as if it's an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and she uses the grainy PBS cinematography and the little model of the town and everything. And there's just something about it that's this, like, weird, I don't know if this is the right word, cathetic experience, cathectic, which I think means that it looks like it, like, has this moment of connecting you to a different time. Like, it literally does feel like it taps you into the child within yourself with all its vulnerabilities and simplicities and innocence, which I guess is what the film is trying to do. Now, that probably doesn't work in quite the same way for you as it does for me as an American viewer. I have to say, I didn't love this movie overall. I think we said last night that it suffers from the Julie and Julia problem.
Oh, yes.
In a number of ways. So one, it's a story about a beloved American television personality played by an acclaimed American actor. But then the majority of the movie is actually this kind of weird frame with a semi-autobiographical, semi-fictitious Cypher character. Mm. So the majority of the film is actually about Matthew Rhys as an Esquire journalist who has a troubled relationship with his father, Chris Cooper. And while there are a few good scenes in that, I thought it was a sort of situation of diminishing returns. Would you agree in terms of that plot line?
Yeah, very much so. But also, just to go back to your thing about watching it as an American, well, pretend, for example, that Mr. Fred Rogers is entirely fictional. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So pretend that he doesn't exist and we all go and see this movie. I still think it would have left me feeling the same kind of coldness that I left the cinema with.
Do you mean that the entire performance rests on the fact that this is a real person who really existed?
The whole crux of the film is that we're supposed to invest all this emotional belief into this person who kind of changed lives, to change children's lives through television and, you know, connecting with them on a deep and intimate and human level. Like, I can get behind that regardless of if it's a real person or not.
Uh-huh.
But it's the same way, like, watching Julie and Julia, whatever it's called. And,
that's what it's called. You know, Julie and Juliet.
Yeah, like, I didn't know anything about Julia Child.
Okay.
But I still could get into that plot. It's like, oh, here's a famous cook with a funny voice.
Well, that was more of a biopic,
yeah.
Julia Child.
And then you clutter it up with this like...
Nonsense.
Well, you know, I gotta say, this film is no Julie and Julia, and that's a compliment, because I love Amy Adams. I wasn't too familiar with her at that point when that film came out, but I hated her in that film, and I hated Julie. I thought Julie needed a good, hard, you know, telling off.
Well, she had a hot boyfriend, Chris Messina. But, okay, putting that aside, I was thinking, as I was watching this and watching Tom Hanks' performance, do British viewers think he's being weird? Because Mr. Rogers, as played by Tom Hanks, might come off as creepy at times, as actually a bit strange, a bit infantile. You know what? I'm going to bring up something. You're going to be surprised by this. So remember we went to see a play called Downstate at the National Theater.
Oh, you're thinking of the older Pedophile.
Well, yeah, so there's an older...
Sorry, guys.
Yeah, so it's a brilliant play by Bruce Norris, if people have ever had the chance to see it. It was a Steppenwolf
production. It
was amazing. Written by Bruce Norris. There's a character called Fred, and who's an older man who's sweet and gentle and plays the piano, but happens to have a conviction as a pedophile. And in the notes of the play, it says, Fred, he bears a striking resemblance to Fred Rogers.
Oh.
And but I think what's interesting is, like, there's a childlike quality to Mr. Rogers that's this weird combination of child and dad. So he has this kind of wisdom, but he kind of has the mentality and innocence of a child. And I can imagine that if you haven't grown up with knowing that that's real and genuine, you're sort of put into this idea of suspecting. I think you kind of expect the movie is going to either reveal that he's darker than he seems, or he's going to have a moment where he lashes out and he's angry. And I actually think that all of this is preamble to the fact that Tom Hanks is amazing in this role, because he walks an incredibly fine line. It's almost like, I want to say saintly, although in the movie they explicitly refuse the title of saint for Mr. Rogers, but I almost want to say it's this like Buddhist Zen experience. Like,
yeah, Buddhist empathy.
They basically present Mr. Rogers as someone whose life's work is to help people control their emotions or take charge of their emotions or understand their emotions,
yeah, but
as children and adults, yeah?
Yeah?
And so he says, like, even though we have anger and feelings bubbling up inside us, we can learn to understand what that is and we can find ways to channel those emotions productively. He kind of presents almost in this, like, self-help way these kind of practices of, like, thinking about the people who loved you into being and, like, turning your emotions to other pursuits, like banging the keys on a piano.
Yeah, and I knew, like, I knew that was coming at the very end of the film.
So that he was going to play the piano.
Yeah, like, there's certain things that he tells us, that which is that if he's sad or angry, he'll do things to kind of express it, and one of them would just be getting your hands and like, smushing them all over the low keys on a piano. And at the very end of the film, this is not a spoiler exactly, he does that. And it's like, yeah, I saw this coming a mile away, because if you accept fairly early on that we're not going to get any insight into this person that somehow makes them darker or makes them more vulnerable or makes them more flawed.
There's hints, there's an interesting moment where...
Yeah, he talks about his sons.
Yeah, so he deflects most of the questions from the journalist, but at one point the journalist says to Mr. Rogers, it must have been hard to be your son, to have you as a dad. And he takes it in and he gives fleeting reference to the fact that one of his sons never acknowledged him as his father because he couldn't deal with the celebrity and he was a very private person, and that the other one was rebellious and difficult, but they've now come to an understanding. And he kind of leaves it there, but then he looks with this expression of, like, I'm going through some things now, which I actually read in Hanks's performance, not just as, like, pain about my sons, but also almost a simmering resentment of the journalist saying, why are you bringing this up with me right now? But you kind of watch him almost contain and check that.
Yeah,
and
he says, Hanks, you know?
It's Hanks doing it.
Hanks all over,
and he says to him, thank you for having the compassion to understand what that must be like.
Yeah.
And
at that point, the journalist kind of is like, okay, we're done here. Because, you know, we, even as viewers, which we accept that this person is wholly good and on the side of the light.
Yeah.
Is also deeply frustrating.
Well, it's hard to play a saint.
Yeah.
And we said this about Pope Francis, played by Jonathan Pryce.
Weirdly, Pope Francis feels more human than Mr. Rogers
does. Well, but that's the thing about... But what's strange about Pope Francis as a character is that actually he's much more of the world. Like, Mr. Rogers literally floats above... And I really did enjoy the way they depicted this, because it's not a 100% successful movie, in my opinion.
No.
It's nowhere near as good as Can You Ever Forgive Me?
And, like, so I heard some people on Twitter saying things like, oh, what, this is totally anti-Mariel Heller, female filmmakers, this film didn't get a whole lot of other Oscar nominations. I kind of went into the cinema with that in mind to think, considering how much we loved Can You Ever Forgive Me, and I kind of thought, no, actually, this is not the same kind of film, and it's not on the same level.
It's not, but here's the thing. A filmmaker, presumably, Mariel Heller, is going to keep making many movies.
Absolutely.
Touch wood.
It's great that she had two quite successful films, one after the other as well.
This is the kind of movie that's not great, but it has a lot that's interesting in it, and I think, actually, it almost feels like a kind of meditative movie, that it's kind of more about the practice of sitting within the movie and absorbing Fred's techniques. Like, there's a point where he asks the journalist to kind of contemplate who are the people who loved you into existence, and then for a minute there's just silence as they sit in a Chinese restaurant and do that. And I definitely did go through the names of all the people who have kind of loved me over my life. Now, it didn't bring me to tears, but it did kind of calm me. Apparently, Sean was just thinking about, you know, I don't know what. What he was going to post on Instagram tomorrow.
Oh, shut up, Brian. Without going into it and divulging too much about my own personal life, there were several beats in that film that would have resonated with me and certain characters as well. On any given day, could have really touched a nerve. I wasn't feeling particularly hard-skinned yesterday. I was ready to be touched emotionally, and I didn't really get it. And during that scene, we're thinking of the people who loved you into existence. I felt it was a bit cloying, and I kind of felt it was gimmicky, and
it's what he really did.
I know, but I sat there waiting for that to pass.
Yeah. I think one thing I loved about the movie was the way he just keeps that consistently. And you can tell that, like, the people who work with him at WQED in Pittsburgh, like, the first meeting we have with him, he's taking 36 minutes to meet with a young boy who's, like, dying of leukemia. And all the other people on the set are like, we're over an hour behind to film the show. Like, he does this every day. And I think, as I have grown up with at least one or two members of my family who have similar qualities to this, in that they're such purely good people that actually sometimes you want to shake them and be like, can you be a bit more normal? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, when you meet kind of truly saintly people, there's a frustration. I felt that the movie gave some space for that frustration to exist and to allow the kind of weirdness and the awkwardness of what it must be like to be continually around Mr. Rogers, the real Mr. Rogers, to, like, wear you down. Yep. And let's just conclude by kind of saying moments or things that we liked about or didn't like about Hanks's performance. Do you think the performance, it merits being here in these list of nominees?
Yes, I do.
Why?
Well, because it's a very difficult thing to do. As I said earlier, you have to accept that Mr. Rogers isn't going to reveal one time he smacked his son so hard that he passed out, you know, or that he was abused as a child.
Or that he fucked 10 prostitutes in the Korean War.
Do you know what I mean? That's just not going to happen. Yeah. Like, and after you know that you're not going to get that, you know, reveal from this character, you kind of have to accept that sometimes people are, I'm saying again, saintly, and that to be saintly, you have to be irritating, or you also have to be sincere at the same time. You know, it's not a role that a lot of people could play.
No, I think basically no one.
Yeah, and it's not about doing a Mr. Rogers impersonation either, because you have to embody a goodness.
Yeah.
And Tom Hanks is the person who can do that.
I think it's interesting, actually, I don't think you saw this film, but interesting compared to Saving Mr. Banks,
much
less successful film that really was made for me to love because it was Walt Disney, it was Emma Thompson.
But you're not a Disney gay. I want to put that on the record.
I used to be, though, Shawnee boy. In my youth, I had dozens of coffee table books about Walt Disney, you know, not just like child books, but like studying about his life and his biography. Walt Disney was a dark and complicated and Machiavellian man. And sadly, because it was a Disney picture, like Tom Hanks's Walt Disney in that film was nothing. It was just like an audio animatronic like symbol. It was not interesting. And that movie had a very simplistic kind of Oedipal story about fathers and blah, and children and blah, blah.
Yeah.
This movie, it's really fascinating to watch someone with Tom Hanks's star quality play this role, because Mr. Rogers is an icon. So when he walks into scenes where he's not expected, like he comes into Matthew Reese's family where Chris Cooper as the father is like recuperating in bed, and he walks in and they all kind of react like it's Mr. Rogers, it works because it's Tom Hanks. Yeah. You know, if it was just another cute old character actor,
if it was Alan Alda.
Yeah, actually, it might
work with Alan
Alda. And I shout out that Alan Alda actually would have been great casting for Mr. Rogers.
Brian.
No, it really would. I mean,
I just said he wouldn't be good, but I said it because obviously, subliminally, I thought he would be good.
He has less of the kind
Tim
of
tenure?
Yeah, but Hanks is doing this thing that like is playing on his own celebrity. He's tamping it down. He's finding this goodness. He's doing an impersonation, but he's also like slyly winking to you that he's Hanks and he's Rogers. It's a very interesting performance, and you may not appreciate this, but that section after he sings the song, like you kind of got to get through him singing the song and zipping up the cardigan and doing all the stuff and the snap, snap, and the shoes, that's expected. But it's then when he sits there next to the picture and he's like, I'm going to tell you a story about a few of my friends. And it's like, you're sitting there being like, oh my God, he's sustaining this.
Yeah.
Like he's doing this. He's finding this quietude in this performance. It's kind of amazing. So I'm happy to have Tom Hanks back. I hope we have many more Tom Hanks performances in the future of the Oscars.
Okay, last thing anecdotal about Tom Hanks. Okay, you know the film Big?
Yeah.
Okay, so how much do you really think that the character of Big spent masturbating when he woke up as a fully grown man?
I don't know, Sean.
Okay, I just want to say that.
But wasn't he like 11?
Yeah, but he would have like, you know, woken up with a fully functioning, fully grown
When member. Did you start getting erections?
Around that time, to be honest. But
I don't know. I don't remember how young the character in Big was supposed to be. I'm so glad that we've decided to include that into the podcast on this very male edition of Broad Appeal. Now, we just mentioned Alan Alda. Of all the people who were in Oscar-nominated movies this year, like movies that got other nominations, the cast of Marriage Story got a number of nominations, but both Alan Alda and Ray Liotta were really overlooked. I mean, I know their roles were kind of small, but they were both great.
Well, Alan Alda especially.
Oh yeah. My God, incredible.
He was like your father, wasn't he?
Well, Tom Hanks in Bridge of Spies reminds me of my father. Alan Alda is maybe a slightly more doddering version of my father, but they're both, you know, they're all lawyers, all those characters.
Oh, your father's a lawyer, right?
So the film is Marriage Story, Sean.
Yeah.
The nominee is Adam Driver. I would say he's probably not the favorite to win Best Actor, but he's definitely one of the people who actually might take home the trophy, right? I mean, he's received critics' awards. He's kind of a star on the rise.
Yeah, you'd hope, wouldn't you? Yeah, so I saw this in the cinema by myself in the IFI in Dublin. I was over for a trip for some reason. And you know I love going to cinema in the middle of the day. It's one of my most transgressive things I think you can possibly do.
Rebel, you've torn your vest.
Oh, yeah. I remember when it was over, I called you up. I actually phoned you from Dublin and said, I don't ever want to be these people. Do you remember?
No.
Do you not remember? I called you up.
I'm glad to know.
Like, I don't routinely call you. Like, well, if I'm away, I don't call
luckily,
you.
Luckily, I'm not a MacArthur Genius Grant winner and you're not.
Oh, yeah, luckily. Yeah. Anyway, back to Adam Driver.
Yes.
So I called you up and said I don't want to be these people. And that's partly because I was affected by both the story and the performances of the film. Like, Adam Driver plays a thinly veiled version of Noah Baumbach, who directed the picture and wrote the film as well, if I believe. Yeah.
I think thinly veiled version is a little bit too simplistic because he's much younger than Baumbach would have been when he divorced Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Well, it's inspired by his own experience.
Inspired by, in the sense that there's a sort of bi-coastal divorce of two people who work in the culture industry.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's one of those kind of movies where, like, the rich cry too, you know, the elite have emotional problems and we're supposed to care about them. You know, you think of it, Woody Allen was the king of doing that in the 1980s. Hannah and her sisters is like, the most affluent family in the world has problems and we have to, like, you know, suffer with them.
Well, Pauline Kael, I think, refers to Hannah and her sisters as having all the depth of a New York Times Sunday Magazine photo supplement.
Yeah. And
dismissive. We love...
Yeah, we're actually balancing a microphone on a Pauline Kael book.
But you and I have a deep affection for... those,
for neurotic
those,
people.
But yeah. Also those mid-career Woody movies, and especially Hannah and Her Sisters.
Yeah, Hannah and Her Sisters is one of my favorite films, and it's a film that, you know, without going into it again, because I'm a deeply private person, plays a part in the early days of our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I'm not really one of those people who can't empathize with characters on screen. Of course I can. I often feel that in this day and age, it might be a little bit harder to do, considering we kind of see the world as much more unequal. And in this, you have two creative people who spend vast amounts of time and money and, like, you know, blood, sweat and tears on dismantling their marriage.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think a lot of people listening to this, and, you know, yourself and myself included, have had relationships that have soured and are in a relationship that needs work, you know, and takes work. The difference is that we're still together and we're happy, aren't we?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is the kind of performance... that even though he's a theatre director and all that kind of stuff, it's one of those kind of unglamorous performances. It's like, he's a man who's getting divorced. That's the story.
Well, okay, the thing I would say, just to talk about your thing about the elite tone of it. I mean, first of all, do you remember that scene where they're really going at it with the lawyers in the divorce court for the first time, and then the judge is like, listen, can we move this along? There's people with fewer resources than you who are waiting to have their cases heard. The thing I would say about Noah Baumbach when he's good and Squid and the Whale, if you liked Marriage Story, I think you've really got to watch Squid and the Whale.
I think how many times on this podcast have you said that?
10,000 times. But it's also a film about divorce, but it's from the child's perspective. And
yeah, I hate the kid in Marriage Story as well. Why are children in divorce films always so irritating?
But here's the thing. In Squid and the Whale, because the Jesse Eisenberg character is actually a teenager, he's truly brilliant. And his dynamic with... what's his name?
Bill Paxton. Bill Pullman.
No, it's not Bill Pullman. It's the other guy.
Bill Paxton.
No. What's his name?
Jeff Daniels.
Yes. God, we're keeping that in. Okay, so his dynamic with Jeff Daniels is so brilliant because he both hates his father and kind of want to emulate being his father. But I think the thing about Noah Baumbach when he works is, like, he doesn't try to do anything other than make the world he knows. Do you know what I mean? Like, he kind of leans into the fact that this is a very privileged, very intellectual, very culturally uppity-up, all-white kind of world. You know, there's these critiques of something like Lady Bird or the work of Greta Gerwig or whatever, and it's kind
of
like...
Yeah, but Lady Bird was actually more of a Salt of the Earth story.
Yeah, but it's still also very white. But yeah. What I'm saying is, like... It's kind of leaning into this is my personal experience. I'm going to present it with detail. There's a long history of this kind of film, right? This kind of middle-brow, middle-class, emotionally, minutely observed drama. I mean, the real comparison, right, is to Kramer versus Obviously, Kramer.
Yeah.
A movie I haven't seen in many years.
Yeah.
Devoted listener Michael Shulman could tell us lots about the making of it and how nasty... Dustin Hoffman may have been to a young Meryl in pursuit of his authenticity, of his method performance, but they both won Oscars for it.
And at the end of the day...
That's all Oscar, that matters.
Yeah, it's all that matters.
Okay, Harvey. Anyway, let's talk... Can we talk about the... I actually think there's a number of good performances in this movie. Laura Dern is probably going to win Best Supporting Actress. I think she's very good in the role. Do I think it's the most deserving performance of the year from a woman? No.
No, but it's a truly supporting role.
It's a supporting role. It's very finely observed.
Yeah.
Laura Dern deserves an Oscar. I actually think ScarJo is quite good in this movie. I've liked her for many years. Yeah. I kind of just... People on the internet who think she's problematic and canceled, I just like don't need to get into it. I think she's good in this. I think she's way better in this than she's in Jojo Rabbit, which is fine, but just, like, forgettable.
You know, but just to touch on Laura Dern for a second, because this is ostensibly a podcast about actresses, you know, when she inevitably wins, this is going to be one of those performances where someone's, where later on we look back and say, oh, Laura Dern from Marriage Story, oh yeah, she totally deserved that. Because one, it's a real supporting character, Two, as you said, it's very minutely detailed. And, like, it's kind of what the category should be for. I think every so often it deserves to be appropriately won.
Sure.
So that's
okay.
How I feel about it.
But we're talking about Adam Driver. Now, can I ask you, Sean, is he an actor that you have had previous positive experiences with? What do you think of him generally?
Well, I first discovered him, like most people did, in that first series of Girls, which I actually watched, even though I didn't watch any of the subsequent ones. You and I are both really bad at television. And then, of course, I kind of watched him pop up in things and Black Klansman.
Kylo Ren.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really think anything of his performance in Star Wars, I'm afraid. It's something that's not a slight against him, it's just this is the universe of Star Wars. I really, really liked him in Black Klansman.
Mm-hmm.
He was excellent. I think he's very good on SNL. He can play comedy very well. And, you know, he's kind of like an old-school 70s actor in the contemporary form, and he's a bit jolly-led, and you know I love that kind of stuff.
He's handsome, he's tall, but yeah, he's got that kind of like...
Yeah.
Big featured face and kind of mop of hair.
And he's intense in that way that, like, as someone who would actually storm out of an interview with Terry Gross is.
Or be completely obsessive, as came across in Michael Shulman's profile.
Yeah.
I mean, like, he does pursue that method thing, like, really intensely. I think that the Dustin Hoffman comparison goes beyond just the fact that they both played clueless dads who get divorced in these two movies.
Yeah.
Is the kind of actor who, like, pursues a role with, like, a single-minded pursuit of his objective. Like,
It's funny you say single-mindedness, and actually, I think this is probably why, again, he's well-cast for this role.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you're an artist, obviously you become single-minded about your work, but if you're someone who's going through a divorce, even the end of a relationship, you do become single-minded. And we know people who've gone through some breakups, and there is a period where all they can do is talk about what's happened to them.
Right.
Because it's a very traumatic and painful experience where something disappears and crumbles, slips between your fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And in this kind of film, we have someone who's so single-minded on his work, who then we see him shift to become so single-minded on divorcing the appropriate way.
Right, but I think that's because...
And getting destroyed by it.
He'd rather not be focusing on the divorce. He'd rather think this can be easily done and dusted. I can contain all these emotions.
Yeah.
And, you know, I teach playwriting people, and so sometimes I have discussions about narrative structure and what's a protagonist. And Marriage Story has been the example I've been trotting out in class recently about, like, who's the protagonist of this story. And I would argue that ScarJo goes on a journey in the film, but actually she initiates all the action because she makes the choice to divorce. And she kind of, with the assistance of Laura Dern, kind of opens up her vulnerable emotions early on in that scene in Laura Dern's office.
Yeah.
And the journey for Adam Driver, who I would argue is the actual protagonist of the film, is to like keep having these obstacles thrown at him about like how difficult this divorce is going to be one after the other. The journey becomes about exactly what you're saying, Sean, which is that he's so obsessed with like getting his latest production of Elektra or whatever play it is that he's doing by Von Horvath or whatever, getting that on, that becomes a way to escape whatever emotions until he's finally forced to approach the project of divorce with the same intensity that he would approach a theatrical performance. So, you know, he's got to cast the right person, okay? So he wants to cast Alan Alda, but he can't. He's got to instead recast with the tough lawyer, Ray Liotta. He's then got to hire his set designer from back in New York to like find him the appropriate apartment in LA that's going to look like he's settled there and has a stable life with his son so that he can impress the inspector or whatever she's called, the woman who comes to visit. And like that scene is kind of where it all culminates in. Like he's been so frustrated and so flummoxed. And then we watch him. I mean, this is, I think, the scene to me that like really reveals the nimbleness of the performance, where over this course of small interactions, he's got to prove to this woman what a good dad he is in this terrible fake apartment while he makes dinner for them and the kid is acting strange and they're doing that trick with a knife and all that stuff. Yeah. And it walks this hilarious line of like comedy and real, real desperation until he's literally bleeding by the end.
You know, and on any other year, this would be an award-winning performance.
It's not like he doesn't have a shot. I suspect if he campaigned more, it's interesting that the two leading contenders here, him and Joaquin Phoenix, are sort of famously distant, intense, and irascible men who don't like to campaign all that much.
Yeah.
But I think Driver takes the cake for having a round of publicity that's about like literally walking out of a studio with Terry Gross, who's kind of like the world's nicest person.
Hey, so what does he do during his Oscar tip? Does he like close his eyes and stick his fingers in his ears?
God knows. I don't know. Honestly. I don't know. Maybe he breathes into a paper bag.
Yeah, I think that's a bit ridiculous.
But okay, can you talk about what other parts of the movie, do you relate to them? Like, do you remember them? Do you love them?
I don't relate to them. Do I love them? No, but I also was very invested in them as they were happening.
Well, what scenes struck
you? This is going to sound a bit off color.
Go ahead.
Lol. But it's these kind of films that make me realize what a prison heterosexuality is.
Well, yeah, that's not off color. Preach it. Preach it,
yeah,
Foucault.
It's terrible. It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
You create this progeny that you're tied to for the rest of your life. And you have to be invested in a child that I don't think you ultimately care about until it's whining in front of you, you know? I think the divorce lawyers are probably the most captivating people to me in this film. Because what the divorce lawyers are saying is that you are hurt, you are victimized, you
let's
know?
Tell let's, your story.
Let's tell your story. And in the process, you'll pay me $25,000 as my retainer.
Yeah.
And then we're going to rinse your partner, like we're going to compromise the other person in their ability to raise the child that you two are fighting over through financial crippledom.
No, I know. It's,
do you know what I mean? I'm sorry. It just drives me up.
But I think, but I don't know if the movie's meant to hate heterosexuality, but it definitely has made you to think that like the divorce machine, the legal machine, is like a dehumanizing process. And can these two characters find their humanity in the midst of this meat grinder that is going to spew them out, right? And it culminates in that big back and forth scene, him and ScarJo going out at the one where he bangs the wall.
Yeah,
do you remember that?
Do you know, that is actually
it's quite an accurate representation of a fight.
It is.
It's the kind that we leave on the cutting room floor here at Broad Appeal, but it's true because they're each kind of like taking one another's words and kind of re-throwing them back at each other.
And ultimately, you're just kind of grabbing at air, saying, why is this person that I love, why do you hate me so much? Why do I hate you so much?
Yeah, but
and it's tragic. This is a melodrama without big flourishes of music. You know, this thing about melodrama is that you are usually bereft of a villain, and that the villain is life, and
the system.
The villain is the system, and you as the protagonist are just suffering through a systematic error.
Yeah, I'll say one last thing because I would be remiss if I didn't mention this. So there's a lot of people who give Adam Driver high marks for a particular scene that comes towards the end and may have surprised many of you, of him doing a musical performance in a piano bar of Stephen Sondheim's Being Alive, the climactic number from Company. Now, I'm going to say a few things about this, okay? He sings it pretty well. I really respect the fact that he included all the interstitial dialogue of the people being like, come on, Bobby boy, you can do it. And like, including like Elaine Stritch impersonations. Like that to me signaled like this man is a true Sondheim obsessive. And apparently he is, as apparently seemed to be
everybody,
Noah Baumbach and Greta Gerwig and the makers of Joker and Knives Out. But the thing to me about that scene is like, what is that? Like, it's like standing in for emotional progress. Like, I could have completely done without that scene. Like, he performs it well, but they're sort of taking the associations that we have with Company and with that song and just inserting that there into the movie. I understand that at that point, he's basically saying, I've gotten through this divorce. My ex-wife has actually learned and moved on, and I've not moved on, and I'm now afraid of being alone. And alone is alone, being not alone, not alive. And we can then get that coda where he goes back to them for the second Halloween. But it felt a little cheap to me to kind of use that Sondheim in that way rather than actually having it as its own story.
Yeah, well, as Betty Davis said, I detest cheap sentiment.
Yeah, well, I will say that I'm looking forward to Adam Driver. Is it with Marianne Cotillard?
Yeah.
In that new Leo Carax movie that's apparently a musical, yeah. Whenever that's going
to
come out.
That'll
be high on my list.
Yeah.
So, we've talked about him as maybe the possibly second most likely to win Best Actor. It would be a bit of an upset at this point. But the person who's been sweeping up most of the precursor awards is an acclaimed actor who's been around a really long time. His earliest nominations were when he was much, much younger. And he's made a lot of movies, I think, and performances that you and I have both enjoyed. He's made a film that I think the word enjoy is hard to associate with the film itself.
Yeah.
And it's certainly rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. That's Joaquin Phoenix as Joker.
Yeah. Now, I actually wanted to devote as little time as possible to this.
Okay.
So this is going to be the shortest segment of the episode. And that's because I really don't know what to say. Like, after this film premiered at Venice and won all those prizes, there was a little bit of a reaction of like, okay, how did this happen? You know,
like, is it this good?
Is it, yeah.
And then, of course, it arrived.
And it arrives. And the thing about it is that, like, I'm an open-minded film watcher. I have to be. It's my job. On a technical level, this film is very pleezing to the eye. Not in a kind of like, I feel good about it, but it is a fully realized world. It's visually quite captivating. It's very cinematic. There's lots of spectacle. But I feel like I've been through a steamroller, because how many times do I need to be flattened by the same plot, you know, of Batman and of DC Comics? Like, I've nothing against it. I love Batman Returns. But this film is, like, you haven't seen it, because I know you don't really like Lynn Ramsey, but this is a kind of a much more commercial and much, much less interesting version of You Were Never Really Here, in which he ostensibly plays a similar character.
Well, I'm interested for you to talk about Joaquin and You Were Never Really Here. The thing I would say about Joker is, and Jojo Rabbit falls into this as well,
which I haven't seen,
but like, both of them on a craft level have very, very impressive cinematography and production design and costume and music and whatever, and editing, with an emptiness at the center, which is an emptiness of whatever they're saying.
Yeah.
And the thing about Joker that's it sort of feels like so glaringly obvious.
And glaringly derivative.
That's what I was about to say, is that it's a completely derivative film. Now, on one level, I guess if we're going to get superhero movies bombarded to us like every few months, right, from DC and Marvel and wherever, I guess I want them to be like weird knockoffs of auteurs that I like. Like, you know, is Black Widow going to be a ripoff of, like, Wong Kar Wai? Like, I don't know, but I'm just saying, like, I guess that's more interesting than just, like, watching a theme park ride. So in this case, we have, like, a really, really on-the-nose, like, Scorsese 70s kind of ripoff.
Yeah.
Which it's interesting to see Gotham City in the 70s. Yeah. It's interesting, I guess, on one level.
Yeah, it's interesting to see a big studio film like this.
Yeah,
as well.
To watch a retread, essentially, of both Taxi Driver and The King of Comedy, but with nothing added, yeah. And actually with everything just kind of reduced to its most simplistic elements. And I'll say this, Joaquin Phoenix is an actor that I have liked a lot in a lot of performances. And not just when he's being crazy and intense. I think actually a performance of his that people don't give enough credit to is Her.
Where oh, he's I like, love that movie.
But that's the thing where he's like so, he's so diminished and contained and small and gentle and sweet. And then you compare that to his troubled chaos in The Master or his like kind of brooding and conflicted sexuality in things like Gladiator, where he's like the weirdly fey gay emperor, whatever the fuck he is, and then of course your favorite, To Die For,
which we
did an episode on. What's your memory of him in To Die For?
Hot teen,
but murderous.
Yeah, murderous. My favorite kind.
What does he do? He's like he's on that the car hood with or trunk. With,
I actually
with
can't remember.
Nicole,
but I do remember he does actually have a hair lip, and I find repaired hair lips to be such a turn on. I find scars and defects to be really quite a turn on.
Bob Hoskins and Joaquin Phoenix, Sean McGovern's Men of the Year. All those are performances of Joaquin Phoenix's that I really, really admire. They show tons of range.
Yeah, and we know he has it.
This role, there's a number of people who I think are going to vote for this, and they're going to say, well, I didn't care for the movie, I didn't care for its politics, but God, he was amazing.
This is why you and I should be the ones voting, and not these
here's
people.
The thing. He wasn't amazing. People. I'm going to say it. He wasn't amazing. What he's doing is a kind of usual bag of tricks, which is kind of like, I'm going through weird weight loss, I'm bursting out into different moods, like, uncontrollably. I'm being kind of catatonic at times.
I'm sympathetic and homicidal.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually have to say, like, for people who are like, Joaquin Phoenix has given pretty, I think, finely observed portraits of loneliness and portraits of mental illness. This movie is not.
No, it's not.
I mean, I would love to know what an actual psychologist thinks of this movie. Because I actually think the way that it depicts someone who's, like, come out of a state mental hospital and is, like, bordering on homicidal and, like, stalking his neighbor, it plays into so many negative tropes about what mental illness is. Yeah. And, like, in the weirdest way, it's not, like, it play-acts at the idea that it's sympathetic to this guy, but actually at the entire time, it's just, like, reinforcing these images of just, like, instability, villainy, and violence.
Yeah, I mean,
and justifying them.
Yeah, I will say, I thought it was going to be an incel movie. It's not actually an incel movie.
It's an incoherent movie.
It's an incoherent, white rage, people with mental illness are killers kind of movie. And, like, in fairness to Todd Phillips, if you're going to completely steal from Taxi Driver and The King of Comedy, you might as well put Robert De Niro in your movie. Do you know?
Yeah.
So there is that too. So
Where was Sandra Bernhard?
Well, there is weirdly.
She should have played the mother.
She's too young, Brian.
It doesn't matter.
She's only 60, 61.
She could have been. She could be Joaquin Phoenix's mother.
I love Sandra Bernhard. I said the most obvious thing in the world. That is like the most obvious thing
she
in the world.
She really should have been in the movie. You could have cast her as anybody.
Well, I think.
She could have been Marc Maron's part.
Hopefully,
she's been like.
She'd
been like, okay.
Okay, yeah, because Robert De Niro would have just. She's chomping at the bit to work with Sandra Bernhard again. Love you, Bobby. Glad to hear from you. Okay, that's the end of that.
So, we've saved the best for last. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I have to say, like, I'm a little bit less than enthused with this year's Oscar nominees as a group. There's moments of hope and moments of despair every year at the Oscars, but you kind of got to weigh them up. And, like, this year, there were far too many nominations for Jojo and Joker and 1917 for me to really get that excited. And while I was happy for all the nominations for Parasite and there's a few things within documentary and international feature, I was glad for Florence Pugh. I was glad for Greta Gerwig. There wasn't a lot to be all that excited about. But the one thing that was not a surprise, but really, really warmed my heart and validated me, and I think Sean, you agree, yeah, and this absolutely. Is the one win that if it were to happen would just like make me burst with joy and come, frankly, is...
Gross.
Sorry. It's an Almodovar movie, so it's fine to combine the high and the low, and to combine the pain and the glory of the nomination of Antonio Banderas in his return to form with the director that made his career, Pedro Almodovar.
Yeah, my question is, are we going to age as beautifully as Antonio Banderas has? I hope so.
I think we'd have to have started from the point of being an absolutely smoldering heartthrob. Like, let's remember, have you seen any of the early Almodovars with Antonio Banderas?
No, I haven't, Brian, but, you know, I'm going to live a long life, and I'm going to have the opportunity to see them.
Promise me.
Who else has anyone listening to this podcast ever seen Pandora and the Flying Dutchman? Okay? No, but I have, okay? I have other priorities.
Can you promise me that you will at least watch Law of Desire with me some point in the next year?
Yes.
And maybe Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down?
I'm not going to make promises I can't keep.
Okay.
You and I have a long life together, Brian.
And so Antonio Banderas... Okay, here, I need it. Give it to me. Give me Madonna in Truth or Dare talking about this Spanish actor she knows.
Well, I don't actually know the lines, I'm afraid.
Give me the paraphrase.
Something like... You know, I've met so many famous people, and the one person I love is Pedro Almodovar, the Spanish director, and that guy who's in his movies, the really sexy Antonio Banderas. I really like him, but unfortunately, he's married. His poor... I gotta say, that film, to quote Monique Hart, his poor ex-wife is gooped in that film. She is gooped.
In Truth or Dare.
The goopery of that poor woman. Like, I watched Truth or Dare, and I think... I don't know how they've done it. I don't know how that auteur Alec Kashishian did it. But he makes Mrs. Banderas seem like such a...
She's like, a pretty Spanish woman.
I know, but it's like she's like a desigual bag-carrying boar.
Well, what I'm saying is, okay, that whole sequence in Truth or Dare is all when she's in Madrid and Pedro's throwing a party for her and she has the hots for Antonio until she realizes that he's married. And, you know, it's great. It's a great little arc, mini arc. You know, at that time, Antonio is this hot, sexy heartthrob. I mean, it's not unlike the Brad Pitt arc, right?
Yeah, not at all. Right? We got two stunners, two former stunners.
Oh, incredible.
Well, two stunners,
you know,
say.
Can I just say, how nice would it be on the red carpet at the Oscars if Tom Hanks and Antonio run into each other and just start making out in a reprise of Philadelphia?
Wait. Making out.
They never got to really kiss in any smoldering way in Philadelphia.
It's so lovely that he is nominated with Tom Hanks, and he's nominated with Colonel Juan Perón. Have I already said that in
That's
the first
true,
half?
That's true, yeah.
Did I say it in the first half?
Don't think you did.
Okay, yeah, it's him and Colonel Juan Perón.
Yeah, Antonio's there in the same kind of lineup. Yeah.
And, you know, Madonna will be performing in London, so she won't be able to... Well, actually... She always throws an Oscar party.
Does she?
Yeah, she does.
Can we get invited?
Yeah, we're on the list. You know, but she does. That's where that photo of her and Lady Gaga emerged. I wouldn't be surprised if, given her Madame X touring schedule, if she was still going back to LA.
I presume
that.
She's rooting for Antonio. There's never been any bad blood between
them.
No,
what I'm saying is, wouldn't it be lovely if, like, she threw her party and she had Jonathan and she had Antonio at the party? And
they'll be at the Oscars.
No, but I'm talking about... She throws a party in L.A.
Oh, afterwards?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, so do you remember Tom Hanks' Oscar speech for Philadelphia, where he says, thank you to my lover, Antonio Banderas, who, other than the real-life lover that I have, is the only person I'd trade her for. Do you remember that?
No, I don't remember that.
Yeah. To be honest, of all the people who've ever won for playing a gay man and ever won for playing someone who's living with HIV... Tom Hanks just gives the best speech of all of them, and the only one that has any merit to it.
Don't
say the word. Don't say anything to do with Dallas, buying, or clubs.
Okay. Well, I was going to talk about Anne Southern in The Wheels of August.
Stop! Okay. So, Antonio Banderas. The interesting thing is we're talking around the performance, and I think for a long time, people kind of dismissed Antonio Banderas as a hunk of meat, as a Latin lover. Like, yes, he was in these Almodovar movies, always being the object of desire, the law of desire, like being crazy, being bisexual, being villainous, being objectified. And he kind of leaves Spanish cinema behind, and he tries to transition to America. He has a few English language roles, but it's interesting that he's then slotted into things like the boyfriend in Philadelphia.
The dad in Spy Kids.
Well, yeah, that's a bit later. I mean, he has success in things like El Mariachi and stuff like that, or like Mask of Zorro, right?
Oh, yeah. But
they don't quite know what to do with him. It's really funny because it's a little bit like an old school 1930s Hollywood thing. Like, you think about, like, the trials of people like Raymond Navarro or
Carlos Montalban.
People like that. They kind of like, they know he's sexy, but they can't quite make the roles for him, and it's weird. He's almost treated like a starlet. Like, you kind of,
yeah,
like putting him, yeah, in the boyfriend role in Philadelphia is a little bit like, he's pretty, we'll just give him like the supportive lover part. Mm-hmm. So there's not been a lot of roles through the middle part of, yeah, his career
in the English language,
in the English language that have allowed Antonio Banderas to show any kind of range. Now, here's some interesting things about him recently. He had a heart attack, has been very well publicized within his campaign for this movie. And he's had this whole kind of change in his perspective on life, which has been, I think it's deepened some of the choices and the roles that he's made. But also, do you know he's like investing all this time into creating a theater company in the hometown of where he lives in the south of Spain?
I did not know that.
Do you know our friend Fernando is in the production of Chorus Line?
Oh, right, yeah.
Produced by Antonio Banderas.
Oh, of course.
It's their first thing.
I know he's also in The Laundromat.
Yes, he is. Now,
great movie.
Having said that you have not seen those early Almodovars, I know that you actually are a bit of a sometimes agnostic on Almodovar, or a bit of like conflicted.
No, but let me just clarify.
Lay it out there. Okay? Clarify.
Well, first of all, I loved him in The Skin I Live In. In fact,
that's what I was going to say.
I got so horny watching that movie, and the people that I was with when it was over, I was like, God, didn't you find that movie sexy? And
yeah, but you liked the tiger. No, you liked the tiger.
I don't want to talk about the tiger, okay?
I don't want to talk about the tiger.
Are you asking me a question here, or are you speaking?
I am. I'm singing, actually, but okay. Go ahead.
I loved him in that, and I've never doubted his ability as an actor, but the thing about Almodovar, I'll say quickly, is that for someone with such an output, there's always going to be a little bit of diminishing returns. My issue with Almodovar, by and large, is that a couple of things. When he started making things on digital, I'm guessing this was an actual choice rather than just the necessity of the industry, is that some of his films look kind of flat, I found recently. And as well as that, I would say that Almodovar's biggest sin is that he doesn't know how to end films. Mm. I feel like his films just end a lot of the time in a way that kind of feels like it's almost like he ran out of money. Do you know what I mean? And I know that's not true.
But I'm, well,
like, you think of it, doesn't Bad Education end with, like, a title card on the screen? It might. It's been a while since I've seen
Bad Education is a masterpiece. I didn't like
Julieta.
You could definitely make that case about Julieta. Julieta was a movie that I think I would need to watch a couple more times to know what I really
think. Well, I don't ever have to watch it a couple more times. Okay. It was quite enough, thank
well,
you very
but
much.
But Skin I Lived In,
loved it. But that also ends pretty badly as well.
Okay. I would take what you're saying and say that Almodovar is now in this Baroque late period where what he's doing is a kind of cycle of self-referentiality where he has, like, nested narratives within narratives. And, like, you have to really go with him on these slippery journeys where it's going to be a story, but then people are going to, like, write a play within the story where something else. We watched Talk to Her recently, and, like, even that has these kind of, like, strange cycles of flashbacks and dream sequences. And you've
I can go with that,
you've got to be behind that kind of thing. And I actually think Pain and Glory is kind of like, it's this late career distillation and recontextualization of every trope that Almodovar has ever done and ever had. And it needs to have within it Penelope Cruz essentially playing both his mother and an actress as his mother, right? Which kind of like is perfect. But it then also has to have Banderas. The depth and the resonance that come out of the fact that Banderas is essentially playing Almodovar himself.
God, wouldn't you love if you had Antonio Banderas playing you?
Obviously, I don't know exactly what Almodovar's personal, like, gait and kind of posture and manner are, but a lot of people have said that in a way, Banderas is, like, actually kind of mimicking and copying them. I mean, like, do you remember the first shot that we see him in the film? I think it's basically the first shot where he's underwater.
Yeah, it's the first shot.
With the kind of scar on his chest, which is presumably his own surgery scar. And so you see this man who's scarred, you see this man who's broken, right? The constant description of all the pain that he suffers for different conditions that he's had. And I think one of the things at first that I really respect about the performance is how kind of creaky and just down he is. The director that he plays in this film is essentially a lonely and successful but isolated and kind of stuck person. He just decides by chance to take up heroin.
Yeah.
Right? And you see him kind of puttering around his well-appointed Technicolor Dreamcoat home, which apparently includes most of the art that Almodovar has in his own house. It's kind of like him walking around Almodovar's own home. And like when he like has to kneel down in order to get the stash of heroin out of the little cabinet, he puts a little pillow down and because his knees hurt. And it kind of like, now, I'm not someone who's as old and rickety as that, but I will tell you, like, my knees, you know, they're not what they used to be. And the hips and like sitting in a chair can sometimes be the hardest thing. So I'm saying, like, there's a lack of vanity in this performance, while at the same time he's incredibly sexy. And so I think you see this man, like, kind of in a really stripped-down way, playing the weight of years and the weight of experience and the weight of the pain that he's had.
Yeah.
And then...
Mm-hmm. I know what you're going to say.
Yeah. Okay. So for this one scene alone, this movie would stay with me. I mean, the whole flashback sequences that involved the young boy stand-in for Almodovar in his childhood discovering sexuality. I mean, they're extraordinary in their own way for their kind of iconic tableau quality of early sexuality, right? And there's a couple of scenes, one of which involves a pendulous member that you just kind of like, both Sean and I did that in the theater. But to me, the centerpiece standout scene and the scene that is both so full of tension and emotion and horniness is the scene where Banderas, as the director, meets an old lover who has come to town and has seen his play. Isn't that right? Like, he's written this play that has autobiographical content, and then this guy, like, approaches him, and they go back to his apartment. Do you remember this scene? Banderas has this thing that he's written, which is essentially like a monologue.
Ah, yes.
And he puts it on. And
the guy plays it.
Yeah, the other guy.
Yeah, the guy plays
but
it.
Then the old lover comes, they go for a drink and they go to the apartment, and there's this long scene where they recount how they were once lovers and the time that they spent together and what it all meant. And this is classic Almodovar, where in one level it's just exposition because it's these long, dense speeches that they're telling you kind of novelistically about a time that's in the past that we're not seeing, and it's like, why would this be interesting? But the smoldering tension and regret between these two actors, who are both over 50 and both look so hot with like their salt and pepper beards, and they're just kind of like leathery muscles. And actually, the other guy's not particularly muscular, but he's quite handsome in that kind of like salt and pepper Spanish mini daddy way.
Isn't this your future?
I hope so. I wish. You tell me. So there they are. But do you remember this? And like, you're kind of just waiting, like on the edge of your seat, for like, when are they going to touch? What's going to happen to them?
Yeah.
Why has this guy come back to his apartment? And they kiss and they make out. And I have to say, like, sure, I know there's a lot of types of people that are underrepresented on cinema. But one thing that is completely never represented is sexually exciting interaction between two gay men over the age of 50.
Yeah, and also that shot is them in near close-up just kissing each other.
And it's like really sucking face.
Yeah, and you know, putting that, you know, front and center is in itself a political act.
I mean, now granted, they're both two really attractive men.
We shouldn't have to make caveats, Brian. Like, it's still underrepresented.
I mean, in terms of elderly people making out, I mean, it's right up there with Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce and The Wife from last year.
I love that movie.
Jonathan Pryce was the real trailblazer here.
Oh my god!
In terms of senior citizen sexuality,
I didn't say actually. I forgot that he was in that, and I hated him in that too because I hate that movie.
To get back to Antonio and his lover, the kicker is they have this smoldering reconnection that's both filled with passion and also with the weight of years. And then the guy's like, "I've got to go back to my wife and my family. Goodbye." And like that to me, the movie lives in this space of memory, and it lives in this space of like remembering what the body used to do, what the desires used to do, the roads not taken, the things that led me to be the person who I am. But ultimately, it's a lonely movie about he's a lonely man who's like addicted to drugs, who's had success, who's like living through a nested series of stories, you know, that are the past that have made him, and now he has to transpose them into art to kind of not let them slip away.
Yeah.
Pain and Glory is a beautiful... I say to people when they say, would I like it? I say to them, well, what do you think about other Almodovar? And this is a nice full circle to kind of bring us back to The Irishman and also to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Like, if you're invested in those three artists and their careers and kind of the way that each of their films has been in conversation with one another, then all three of those films, I think, are kind of incredible last statements, whether they turn out to be the last movie these people's made. They're kind of last statements of kind of like what their work has been all about. And in each of those instances, they're using actors that they've worked with many times before, who kind of know how they work and know what their material can offer. And that's why there are, in each of those films, there's so many really rich multi-layered performances, because it's this kind of collaboration between actor and director.
That's beautiful, Brian. That's a beautiful way to end your segment on Pain and Glory.
Thank you.
Yeah. So my final question is, you and I are Oscar voters.
Oh.
Who are you voting for?
In both categories.
Yeah, both categories.
Well,
And go with your gut instinct, please.
I'll tell you, I'm going with my head.
Okay.
I'm going with my heart.
Yeah.
I'm going with my dick. I am voting for Antonio Banderas and Brad Pitt.
Okay.
And I not just because they're the most stunning men to ever even be nominated, but also they've given like incredibly soulful movie star roles that have great actor notes within them.
Yeah. I'm voting for Antonio Banderas and Al Pacino.
Really?
Yeah, I decided this because like I'm biased toward The Irishman. If you've listened all this way, you'll know that from the first half. And you could say that Pacino is being hammy in places, but, you know, Jimmy Hoffa was a big, big personality. And having rewatched it again, in the second half of the film, when we know the fate that's going to happen to Jimmy Hoffa and we know what's kind of happening to him, he's a slightly more whitewashed version of what we'd seen previous. And I find that kind of heartbreaking. I love Joe Pesci, but for me, it's Pacino. Yeah, sorry about it.
Well, Brad's going to win, I think we can safely bet.
And I'll be delighted.
I'll be happy for that.
I'll be delighted, yeah.
Okay, so Sean, presumably we're going to watch the Oscars this year. I'm hoping that there's going to be some other things besides Brad's win that we can be happy about.
Yeah, well, Sigourney Weaver is apparently opening an envelope.
Mm, that's good.
Yeah.
I wonder what she's doing.
Well, you know, she's promoting
Best visual effects? Avatar.
She's promoting her brand new film, My Salinger Year, which is opening the Berlin Film Festival.
If there's a reference to unobtainium, I'm there for her.
This Oscar is like unobtainium.
Most of you, including me, will never attain one.
Yeah.
Okay, so there may be some things that make us happy at the Oscars. I have a question. Have you enjoyed this time back together?
It's been really long, Brian. I think it's a very long
We kind of
episode.
Really settled into it in the second
yeah,
half.
We did. Well, I don't know what the first half is like. Maybe we can re-record some of it.
Hey, old friend, what do you say, old friend?
So when we listen to it, and then if I don't like the first half, we'll just do it again. And I want you to keep this in the podcast.
I'm definitely not going back and doing that whole thing all over again.
Well, maybe sound smarter, will you?
I couldn't if I tried. folks, we don't know what the That's future of Broad Appeal will be. Sean is very busy. It's very hard to schedule time with this young man.
But yeah, I'm having quite a year.
But if you've enjoyed this, and you've enjoyed having us back, you can cajole us, you can promote us, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Broad Appeal Pod, or in fact, none of you ever got in touch with us that way. So why don't you get in touch with us at our personal Twitter handles? I'm at VA Mullen Speaks.
And I'm at Sean McGovern X.
If you're passing through London, find us at our many events, or indeed in Dublin when Sean is running the incredible Gaze, GAZE Film Fest in the first weekend of August?
First weekend of August, yeah.
First weekend of August. Check it out. Check us out. Keep an eye, because we may have the time, we may have the inclination to do another series of episodes sometime soon.
Yeah, they're all planned, we just gotta do them. All right.
But for now, ladies and gentlemen, we're happy to be making these episodes for all you wonderful people out there in the dark.
Okay. Goodbye, Norman. That was very good.